With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to It's Anita Rani. Today, I am going to be talking to Anushka Shankar. For those of you who don't know who she is, by the end of this podcast, you will have fallen in love with her. She is an incredible sitar player. No, she's probably one of the best sitar players on planet Earth. Her father was the legendary Pandit Ravi Shankar, the man who introduced the Western world to Indian classical music. And she is his protege. She learnt from the master and just ran with it. This is an amazing podcast because I've recently got to know Anushka. She's somebody that's been on my radar for years. I've always been in awe of her, actually, because she's a master musician. I love the music she plays. She is taking classical music and she has brought it on to a new level because she's worked with a lot of Western artists. She's had her work remixed. If you've never heard of her, you really need to check her out, Spotify her once you've listened to the podcast. Some of her stuff will absolutely blow your mind. And what she does is beyond playing an instrument. She is at one with that instrument when she connects to it. So for then to connect with her and sort of get to know her a little bit and then be invited to her home to interview her, just me and her, in her private studio, which she's had built in her home. I mean, it's making me feel goose pimples just talking about it. She's got some of her sitars put in special display cabinets lit up. I mean, the room, the environment we're in is magical. The whole experience is wonderful. And also, she really opens up and talks about some quite horrific things that she's been through in her personal life, which she's been very open about and has talked about a lot in the press. And actually, she was involved in a big play about it. So after the big rape case that happened in India that really shocked the world, and India really came together, they called her Nirbhaya, the young girl that was raped on a bus. A lot of famous women in India came out to talk about their own experiences of abuse. And remarkably, Anushka Shankar was one of those brave women who did it. By someone of her status coming out and talking about that, it has changed the way people engage and talk about those horrific experiences, particularly in an Asian environment where nobody talks about those things because there's so much shame attached to it. So she's incredible. She's talented, she's gifted, she's beautiful. She's a single mother of two young children. And you need to hear this podcast because you will be blown away by it. So enjoy. Hi, Anushka.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm wonderful. I'm so glad we found the time to do this. I've come into your beautiful home and you've smuggled me into this. Is this your woman cave? Explain where we are.
This is totally my woman cave. So you were upstairs and you saw my younger kid and the older ones at school. And up there it gets very loud and very rackety and lovely and boisterous. And then if I need to, I come down in here and I shut the door and it's my soundproof studio. And it's my little space.
Did you have this specially built in the house? Because you live in this, I mean, I don't want to give away, but this phenomenal warehouse apartment. I mean, it is an amazing place to live. And this was this specially built?
It was, and I'm really lucky to have it. You know, we kind of built this space with the idea that we could work and live here, you know, have creative life and family life and all that stuff. And so it's really nice because as someone that for a living I tour, and increasingly with two little ones, I do find that very, very difficult. So at least at home when I'm working, when I'm writing music, when I'm recording, I can be home. And so I can get all the breakfasts and dinners and lunches and breaks, you know, because I'm working downstairs, which is amazing.
A hardcore working mum who, as we walked in, and Anushka just flicked the light on this beautiful cabinet and has just illuminated three stunning sitars. Tell me about what I'm looking at.
Well, you're looking at my moment of jealousy, where kind of all my life I saw my friends with lovely guitar cabinets and guitar stands and things, and those don't really exist for sitars the same way. And I, when we were building the studio, I was like, oh, can I just have like a pretty display for my instruments? And actually what it is just, you know, this lovely kind of mesh wire screen, copper wire screen we use to kind of protect them from dust and vibrations and stuff, but in a way you can still see them and enjoy how beautiful they are, because they're my babies and they're lovely.
They're absolutely stunning. You've brought us mince pies.
And I really want another bite right
yes,
now.
I'm going to
So
a bite
ask
as
me
well.
A long question.
I'm going to ask you, cheers, by the way, I'm going to have a bite. Look, so these are homemade mince pies.
Not made by you, made by a friend. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and Nishka's already stuck it. Like, this is going to make great, great podcast material. Oh my gosh, delicious.
Right.
Not pastry.
By a two-year-old. Thanks, Liotti.
Liotti, get on Bake Off. Just do. When are they doing? They must be doing Kids Bake Off soon. Okay. And a sip of tea.
Yes. I've done it the last 4 days in a row. Cheers. And it's turning into a ritual where I want my mince pie and my tea, and it's amazing.
It's that time of year. It's absolutely mm-hmm. that time of year. We're both sitting on the floor. We've both got our feet, shoes off. And I don't know, where do we even begin, right? There's so much to talk about with you. I love the fact that the reason I'm here is because you and I have kind of got like concentric worlds. We've got mutual friends mm-hmm. and I've kind of known about you for a while, and we've known about each other, and then all of a sudden we've just come into each other's lives, and that's really great.
It's amazing. And yeah, exactly. I've kind of known of you for a while and kind of met you in social things for a while, and I don't know what suddenly happened the last few months where it's just gone boom. And I love when it happens with friends of friends in that way, where you kind of go, okay, that person I love that much loves this person that much, so I already know they're wonderful.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of trust when you first speak.
Yeah,
absolutely. And for me, it's also about, I'm getting to that point where now I'm meeting really cool women. You get to an age where you think, okay, I've had friends that I've known from different phases of my life, but now when I meet awesome women, it's like instant. It's like you there's an understanding where you kind of get where you've come from, how hard you've worked, where you're at, and like there's no bullshit, is there?
No, there isn't. And I get what you're saying about this kind of identification of other strong women, where you go, okay, I don't necessarily know the details, but I get what you've done.
Yeah.
And yes. I applaud it and support it and want to be a part of it.
Exactly, exactly. And enhance each other's lives. But I want to talk about your career, because let's introduce who you are to my audience. Hello, my audience. Hello, my podcast audience. This is super exciting. In the intro, I mentioned who your father is, phenomenal Ravi Shankar. I mean, were you always destined to be a sitar player? Did you have a choice?
Let me chew my mince pie in.
Go on, chew your mince pie. I'm going to have a sip of your tea. I'm sure I'm not going to ask you anything original, by the way. I do apologize for that now.
What is funny about questions like that is I've been asked that since I was 13, and the answer has changed over the years. So even though it's not like a new question, it's a new process. Do you know what I mean? As a teenager, I would have said, no, of course not. You know, I've completely been given the choice I want to have and all this stuff. And then in my 20s, I maybe said, well, yeah, there was some pressure, but I always knew what I was getting into. And now increasingly, I kind of go, yeah, no, there on one level, there wasn't much choice, because I was told there was choice by two very loving and supportive parents, you know, who really wanted me fundamentally to be happy. But at that young age, it would have been impossible to escape the scenario, if you know what I mean. Like, I knew who my father was. I knew how many people would have wanted me to, quote unquote, follow in his footsteps. And I knew he really wanted me to, as much as he also just wanted me to be happy. He really wanted me to play as well. So as a kid, that meant that, of course, I said yes. Even though I was asked, of course, I said yes. So it was a kind of mixed bag. It was a mixed process of feeling pressured, not that I was being actively pressured, but feeling very pressured, but also loving music and loving it and having grown up in the environment, enjoying it, finding my way with it. And fundamentally, I think the older I got, I didn't want to deny myself the fact that I did love it because of the pressure. So I kind of swallowed the pressure, if that makes sense, in order to keep doing what I loved.
You get to spend all that time, because he was your dad, obviously, but he's also your guru, mm-hmm. you know, your musical master. Sort of explain what that means.
In Indian classical music, it's an oral tradition. So what that means is the music is passed down from guru to student, one generation at a time. And that puts the teacher, the guru, at the kind of center of the learning process, much more than in any other musical style where a teacher is hugely important, but the material is kind of available. They become your direct source for everything. And there's a respect afforded to that, which is correct, you know, that really puts them in the Indian belief system, almost in a position of godlike. And that's a beautiful thing. It comes with a lot of respect and reverence and a very beautiful relationship. But when it's also your parent, that can be really tricky. And I give my dad all the credit on that one, that he was deeply averse to just having a very formal guru and student relationship with me. And so he put a lot of work into sort of, as when I was a child, dividing our relationship, almost sometimes as simply as based on what room we were in, you know, that like, we're in the living room now, we're being casual, this is, I'm your dad, and we're hanging out, and you can say things, you can argue, you can, I'm in here, we're in the music room, and this is a bit more serious and a bit more formal, so give me your focus, and, you know, let me teach you. And we sort of carved out this way of dipping into the different dynamics as and when were appropriate. And then, of course, as the years went on, that became one big multifaceted relationship.
Yeah, wonderful. And you went on tour with him. And, you know, just amazing.
It was extraordinary. I mean, we toured together for, I guess, 22 years or something. You know, I started performing when I was 13. And then by the time I was 14, I was doing all his shows. And so we just went on the road together.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's phenomenal. I mean, you're only 36. Mm. I shouldn't. Do you mind me saying your age?
No, don't mind.
I'm older.
Ask me in a couple. Yeah, she's older than me.
I'm older. It's fine. Like, you've done so much. I have to say, in your defense, I am sure, and you probably know this, that had you not really taken to it in the best way, I'm sure your dad would have gone, it's okay. Yeah. Go and do what you want.
Just go do something else. Yeah. It's fine, honey.
You've obviously got the gift. We know you've got the gift.
Well, I mean, talent's a funny thing. I think you can have talent, and increasingly I find that's okay to say. Like, talent's just something, like, I have black hair, you know? So, yes, I have a musical aptitude, and that's fine. And I think having, you know, an ability to learn languages or a skill with language or a skill with music can help. And then it's what you do with it. And I think in my case, that was what I put into it and also what my dad put into it, you know, because as a teacher, he really was an incredible teacher. And so I got so much out of that. But then, of course, I brought myself to it.
Of course.
My own practice, my own focus. And that's, you know, I think that's where you get what you get from.
Yeah, of course. And it's no different to kind of a lot of, you know, parents bringing their children, you know, children of doctors becoming doctors or whatever, actors, if we're thinking about India, mm-hmm. a lot of them go into the film industry. But obviously then at some point you made a decision that this is something that you want to pursue as a career for yourself. Mm-hmm. And that came at a really young age as well, didn't it?
Well, I think I was forced into a decision.
Now I'm going to eat the mince pie.
Okay, I'll try and make this answer nice and long until you finish chewing. I was forced into a decision at that point where everyone else was going to university. So I was in high school and as I say, I'd been touring. So it was very tough what I did, actually, because I toured around the world and was going to a normal high school at the same time. So sometimes I'd leave for 2 months, carry my paperwork. You know, it wasn't anything extraordinary, but it was a kind of focus that I had on wanting to have a normal life, but also wanting to have this touring career. But at that crossroads moment of like everyone else was going to university, that was when I really had to look at what I was doing and go, well, I can't keep doing both at this moment in time. Do I want to put music on pause and go to university for 4 years? Or do I want to put university on pause and fully go into touring? And the answer felt quite clear at that point that, like, I already loved touring and that was what I wanted to do. So I put it on pause for 1 year and then I put university on pause for a second year and then it's like, ah.
And you've released how many albums now?
9.
And how many Grammy nominations?
6.
I'm laughing because it's amazing. And you were the first Indian to perform at the Grammys, is that right?
Yeah.
You were, when was that? 2000?
2005, so I was 24.
24 years old, and there you are performing at the Grammys. I mean, is that something you just take in your stride because you've seen your dad be so phenomenal? Or do you also have moments where you go, holy crap, I'm playing the sitar at the Grammys and I'm the first Indian to have done so. That, I mean, that's massive.
It was awesome. And I was completely excited by it. I mean, almost, it's tricky. Like, I appreciate your question of like, did that not feel like a big deal because of all the things that he had done? And of course, the flip is true as well, that it felt like a really big deal because of all of the things he had done, that there was something that I was being asked to do and being recognized for. And that felt really lovely. And stuff like that does feel really good. You know, in I try and keep it all in the right perspective, but it is exciting and it is lovely. And I think in that world music category, I was I was the first Indian woman to be nominated, and I was the youngest person ever to be nominated, and that kind of stuff. Yeah, it does feel good. It does feel good.
What I really like is that your albums, there was a point where you decided that you didn't just release classical Indian albums. You wanted to do something a bit different. Tell me about what that process was. I'm very aware that we've not even looked at the instrument as well. We're going to, is that the one you will do it?
Well, I'll dig out another one.
You'll dig out one. And we'll talk about the sitar in a minute. But yeah, you made a decision to move away from just classical Indian music.
Well, you know, I grew up in a kind of one side, very normal life, and on the other side, this very extraordinary life with my dad and touring. And so as a result of that, I had these sort of dualistic elements to my music input as well, where I was also listening to all the things my peers were listening to. And I was friends with lots of people who were making very non-classical types of music. And I was going and dancing to their music at the clubs, and I was part of that world. But then the music I was making was going on tour and playing sitar and releasing, you know, classical raga music. And I think the point came in my early 20s where it wasn't so much a desire to make, you know, in a label sense, classical versus non-classical music, but I wanted to make my own music, and just that desire to have your own creative voice come out. Whereas I'd been playing my dad's music up until that point. And that was the decision of like, I want to take a little bit of time and just find what my own voice is when I make music without kind of preconceived boundaries or limitations. And then obviously what ended up happening was I made music that reflected my personality and my life and all the multiculturalism that had been at play since I was born. So that's kind of just what happened, really.
And I loved it because that absolutely spoke volumes to me. And you can imagine, like, growing up in up north in Bradford in Yorkshire as an Indian girl who loves, actually I loved classical music bizarrely without it kind of really being part of my life, but just loved it, Indian classical. But then also dancing in clubs and listening to electronic music. And that, so when I hear, oh my God, Anushka Shankar's just done an album, and it's like, and she's done this and she's worked with Kush Kale and there's all these, it's like, what? Like, it blew my mind.
Really?
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah. Like I've got it on my iPod and I've listened to them over and over and over. Yes.
Thanks.
Yeah. So it spoke, it really did. It really was for me, absolutely. Yes, that's exactly what you should, why not?
Yeah.
You know?
And I hear what you're saying about it being an Indian woman as well, because like now there are a lot more Indian women that are very kind of visible in that sort of multicultural base in the arts, and there weren't really at the time. So yeah.
Yes, you've been flying a flag for a long time, which has been great. Can we have a look at a sitar?
Yeah, jumping straight
to it. Let's do it. There's so much we can talk about. This room is so beautiful. No, it's nice and cozy. And you've got a little, is that a mandir you've got there? What's your little temple?
Someone gave me Ganesh.
Yes,
oh,
come.
A nice Ganesh.
You've got a Ganesh down there playing the sitar?
Funnily enough.
Wow.
So I thought, I know exactly what room that's supposed to be in.
Yeah.
And a couple of other little toys. There's a piano, there's a harmonium, there's...
A piano, a harmonium.
There are boxes.
Can you play all of them? Can you play piano?
Play, sure.
Of course.
Yeah, let's call it yes.
Yes. This is the answer. So, right, now this is really exciting.
This is my main sitar. And it was made in Delhi by Sanjay Ricky Ram about 8 years ago, and it's been my main instrument since then. Very much kind of made for me to my body shape. I have not tuned it, so it's probably going to sound horrendous until I tune it. So
you tune.
Yeah.
When you mention the name of the...
Yeah, see, it sounds horrible. It sounds like it's been a shot. Oh, this is embarrassing.
Sounds amazing. Isn't there a famous thing where your dad was tuning on
the Bangladesh concert? Yeah, where he starts tuning and everyone started clapping. And he picked up the mic and said, well, if you like the tuning so much, I hope you like the first piece.
I love that. I have seen it. So, right, explain how you're tuning it, because there's lots, right? Talk me through
tuning
what's going on.
Tuning a sitar is a complicated event. There are 19 strings, but 13 of those are what we call the sympathetic resonating strings, and that's what I'm fiddling with right now. And the problem with them is, the beauty about them is that they resonate when you play on the main strings. The problem with them is, therefore, they have to be perfectly in tune, because if you've got one of these strings out of tune, then they'll zing out of tune when you play on the main string. So get these in shape, and then get the main strings in shape. These are two rhythm strings, which you tune to the tonic, and they're used to kind of punctuate phrases, but also in fast rhythm sections and stuff like that.
And it's beautifully ornate as well.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
It's a stunning,
stunning instrument. What's it made out of?
a mix of wood and a gourd. This part, the base at the bottom, is a dried pumpkin. Did you know that?
I learned that recently and I didn't believe the bit. They were like, it's a pumpkin. That is remarkable. Yeah. Why? Why a pumpkin? Why not actually make it out of wood?
Well, I don't think you can get this shape and this texture out of wood, and that's just traditional, and now they're grown specifically for that. And yeah, they've got little pumpkin molds sitting outside in the back garden or something. I don't know. Getting there. And then you've got four main playing strings. So four main playing strings, two rhythm strings, 13 rhythm strings, which are still not quite there. We're close.
And Sanjay Ricky Ram has got his name on it, especially made for you. He's obviously the man. He's the man.
He is the man. His grandfather started making instruments, and then his father made instruments for my dad,
and then he made one for you.
There you go.
I love that Indian tradition where things are passed down through family.
It's funny, isn't it? Because in a way, I go, oh, I've never asked him whether he was forced into it, and whether, but it's such a common thing, passing on what you have. There we go. Okay. So then here's my main string. Almost, as I say, complicated process.
I'm having an out-of-body experience. Well, I've just dawned on me that I'm sitting with you in your recording, in your studio.
Closer to me than Anita.
I'm basically sitting on top of Anushka.
My instrument, here is Anita. And
it's amazing.
I can't,
this
is
not.
Thing, isn't it?
Okay, well, yeah. So it's tuned. Yeah, is it very, like, can we ask the cost if somebody wants to buy? I mean, obviously this.
Depends, you know. I mean, I think this one's obviously made specifically for me with a few details that are specific to my body size and shape. But you can't, I mean, it's nothing like the Western classical instruments. You could get like the best sitar for under £2,000, which is really not that much if you think that like someone would have to spend 10,000 to 20,000 on like the best saxophone or something.
Yeah, or a violin could be $1,000,000.
Of course, then you're in that range. Yeah. So there's one instrument back behind you there, which is one of only five sitars made by this man called Nodu Malik, who made sitars exclusively for my dad. And so there's only five of them in the world, and they're really exceptional instruments. So I don't know what the price on that one is, you know, because it's very much a one of a kind, even more so than a Stradivarius. But, you know, the costing's just different.
And I guess, well, this is yours, so this is priceless. So can we, I don't know, I don't even know what to ask you to
play. Give us something.
I'll give you something, and you'll have to. I'm just going to put in a caveat that the last time I played my instrument, embarrassingly, was the 5th of November at that show in Bombay. And today is the, I don't know when you're going to release it, but today's the 12th of December, so I'm a good 5 weeks away from my last.
And can that make playing? That can have an effect?
It's horrific. I mean, if you see my fingers, which they can't see, but 5 weeks ago, I had really solid black lines dug right into my finger and no sensation. And now I'm starting to feel my fingers again, like the skin has softened very much. And so right now, I will try and play for you, but it'll do that. It'll slip off the string and it'll. And my string went completely flat.
It's beautiful.
Oh, honey.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're in here. It's embarrassing to do this for an interview, but
no,
this is so I get in funny cycles with playing where, you know, up until November 5th, for about 3 months, I was playing 6-7 hours a day. And then we were crazy tours. And then that was my last show in the diary for the year. And I don't want to play for a while. I need to stop.
So this is really special then for me, for this podcast. Yeah. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
My worst for you, love.
Yeah. I know. Cut. Her worst is still the best in the world. Is your baby
a little neglected? And
amazing.
Start doing
my scales again tomorrow.
Oh, no, thank you so much. I mean, that is a beautiful, what's the white bit around the edge?
So, you know? Traditionally, it was kind of deer horn, and now it's plastic. And they use enamel and different things to do the colored ornamentation. And again, here on the bridge work and stuff, traditionally horn. Now they tend to do new instruments with plastic. This one is still the old horn bridges. I think they're still working on trying to make the plastic sound as good as the horn, which would be very nice when they do.
I'm still trying to get over the fact that I've just been practically sitting on top of you, listening
you were
to you
pretty
play.
Much in my lap, yeah.
I know. My hairs are standing on end. My palms have gone all sweaty. I mean, it's stunning. There's just something about, for me, it's about, it connects with my heritage, and it echoes deep, really echoes deep. But just to hear someone who's so good at what they do, and you know, the top of in the world, to play like that, yeah, amazing. Thanks.
Thank you.
So how do you do it? You're an international sitar musician superstar. You have this, of course, beautiful home, and you've got your recording. So you've got two children. You're a mum. How do you make it all work? How do you just come back from a tour where you went to India? Mm-hmm. How do you do it?
I don't know. I mean, I do a lot of work, on on myself, and on trying to make decisions from the right place. You know, and there's been a kind of learning curve through having children that has been sometimes a process of trial and error, you know, where the first year that my older boy Zubin was born, that year had already been booked 2 years before that. So it was booked on the basis of me not having children. And so the year he was born, I did 96 shows, and he was just kind of on tour with us. And my sound men would kind of just build a bed into whatever tour bus we were on, and off we would go. And it was an amazing adventure. But the next year, the level of exhaustion I felt from having not known what I was going to get into. I think a lot of women, you come into having kids and you don't know what it's going to be like. And you don't know what the differences are between, for example, my male musicians who I work with, and they have kids and they go on tour, and their partner is the one that's at home making sure the kids are all right. And then there I was trying to do the same thing, but it wasn't as easy, you know, and I crashed really badly. And I also found, obviously, with my kid, that there was this kind of adventure, but a lack of stability and a lack of, and I thought, no, I need to scale back. And scaling back has been a different process year by year. You know, sometimes it means still 40 or 50 shows, but in a way that I've really designed very carefully to know that I'm able to still be solid and be their mum. And sometimes it means, no, I can't do that. And I need to be here to make sure things are solid. And now I've got two, and that became exponential, obviously. So I kind of went, right, I know what it's like to have a kid now, so I can do this. And then suddenly there were two, and I didn't know what that was like at all. So it's a learning curve.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Learning curve, and we don't get it right all the time.
How did you get your energy? You said you crashed really badly. I mean, I'm not surprised. Newborn, 96 shows. I mean, good you know, amazing that you did that. So what did you do? How did you come back from that? What, like, did you just lock the doors? That's it. Time out.
I didn't. I wish I had. I mean, I think learning to do less has been a lifetime lesson for me, because I was kind of born into a family of doing, you know, and you play and you perform and you travel. And that's what, you know, there's legends about that, family legends about the kind of things that family members, including my dad, have done and what they've played through. And even when this was happening, they still went and played. And there's that kind of show must go on mantra, you know, which I absorbed. And then in my own life, I've started to realize I don't always buy into, where I think actually right now it's not about the show going on. You know, it's about making sure I'm okay to do the next 100 shows by being okay right now. So I did cancel some things at that point, and from there have just been really, really careful about what I try and commit to. And a lot of, when I said I do a lot of work, I mean, some of it has just been trying to operate really clearly on what my values and priorities are. You know, because I've spent my whole life being a musician where that's always come first. And in the last few years, obviously, that's changed and that doesn't come first anymore.
Was that natural?
No, it's not been natural. I mean, in some ways, yes, there's an instinctive thing of like, obviously, I love my children more than my instrument. Like, that's innate and that's obvious. But when that comes down to like, would I selfishly rather go and be able to do every big career thing that I'm asked about? Yeah, sure, I would. You know, but I start to learn that there are consequences about how much I'm away from my children and what that does for them. And I'll never get that back once I've done it, you know. So, you know, there are definitely times where I have to kind of say no to something amazing and then watch someone else do it. And that's life, isn't it? Like, it's just been a process of learning that you can't do everything all the time.
Sadly, that's life for women more than it is men.
Yeah.
The idea that we can have everything.
It's bullshit.
It's absolute bullshit.
I feel like I was spoon-fed my whole life this lie about what it was going to be like in this post-feminist society that I thought I was growing up in, you know. And then suddenly you realize it was complete bull.
I totally agree. Mm. Yeah, we're told you can have everything, you can do everything. So much pressure. Mm-hmm. It's actually so much pressure. It's like, I get it, but it's actually, yes, as a woman, you can have kids, you can have a career. Mm. Actually, no.
And that's why I'm really careful when people do that thing of asking that question of how do you manage it all, you know? And I say, I don't. It's really hard, because I feel like I used to read interviews with other people, and especially when I was in that kind of confusing phase after having my first kid and was trying to figure out how to do it. And you'd see like this celebrity's bounced back to their body 5 weeks after their, and look, this one's making 3 films and that one. And the spin is always just look how they're doing it. They're doing it all perfectly. They're doing it all easily. And I just think, you know what? Like, I don't need to absorb that. Nobody else needs to absorb that.
No one knows what she's going through and the sacrifice she's made. And also, you know, this kind of celebrity, like they will have help. They may have a trainer, you know, and if she's off to do a movie, then she'll be made, someone will be making sure that she's looking like that to get in.
Mm-hmm. So the whole thing is just a nonsense.
Exactly. And I think just to try and be honest about that. So if someone else is reading an article where they say to me, how do you do it? That I'm saying it's really, really hard. And like one day at a time, and try and make the best decision. And, you know,
and you have to make sacrifices. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your choice, yeah. Obviously.
And I think that's the key, is like when I talked about my priorities and my value system, it's like, it's not for me to make my children make sacrifices. Like, as an adult, I can make sacrifices. I have that choice, and I can't make that choice for them. They didn't choose to be born to a busy sitar player. You know what I mean? So it's like, I go, okay, I need to make sure they're okay first. That's the first thing. And then from there, what all can I do?
Lucky them. They've got the best mum, and they're absolutely beautiful. Yeah. I met the little one. Oh my God, he's to die for.
He's edible.
Yeah, he really is edible. I'm glad you said that. It's actually a condition, because I see like really chubby babies, and I want to bite.
I just said that about someone else's child this morning. I said, this thing is happening in my mouth where I want to just.
Do you think since you've had kids that it's kind of, I don't know, changed something about you as a woman that's made you see the world in a different way and solidified? I feel like in the last few years, I hear a lot more from you, and you're very outspoken about how you feel about things politically and certainly things that have gone on in India. Like, you've really put your neck on the line and stepped up and gone, right, well, this is me. You all know who I am, and this is how I feel about this. And is that something that's happened since you've had your kids, or what?
Yeah, unequivocally. I can't necessarily analyze it, but I know that having kids makes everything feel a lot more precious and urgent. And so when things feel unjust, there's an urgency to my worry that's selfish, actually. It's about my children and their future, and where I care about the world. And when you see things happening to other children, it feels at least for me, I feel that more deeply than I used to before, because I know how I feel about my children. So I know that those kids are someone else's kids, and they, you know, I just know what that would be like, and it feels more wrong. And even just my feminism has changed. The quality of my feminism now feels a lot more, to be honest, impatient and angry, where I'm just over the kind of gentle process of going, well, maybe it could be a little bit, oh, come on, you know, I just want this world to be better.
Yeah, I'm with you. I feel the same. I don't know what, loads of things have probably happened. It feels like all of a sudden there's this new wave of feminism where everyone's like, right, enough is enough. How can we still be talking about equality? Yeah. How can this conversation still be happening? And I guess other things have happened where the world is becoming more and more right wing, and men are, you know, we can see what's happening around us, and all these kind of sexual abuse scandals that are coming out. You've got Trump in America, the whole thing. And I think women have just gone, right, if we don't speak up now, then when?
Yeah. If not now, when? Really, that's it. And I think, again, coming back to that idea of like, I think I internalized and spoon-fed a fiction that feminism, I've always been a feminist. It's not that I thought it wasn't relevant anymore, but I believed that we had done more than we really had. You know, because when you grow up and you read the history books, you know, whatever little there might be, it feels like it's a past fight for votes, or it's a past fight for equal pay, or, you know, and then the more I'm in my adult womanhood and looking around at the differences between women and men and girls and boys, and the huge, vast discrepancies and inequalities, and kind of how systemic it is, it feels like an oppression, you know, and it feels like that can't still be what's happening to an entire half of a population.
It's an oppression, and it's unjust, and it needs to change. Like you say, it's half the population. You've got a really unique perspective on the world as well, though, because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you kind of straddle three countries, right? I mean, yeah. born in the UK.
Grew up in California and India. Yeah, and I feel tricultural, which is my new favourite word.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, feel free to use it. Where it just has been interesting for me, because I do often get a kind of constant global perspective. Well, I shouldn't call it global, but a multifaceted perspective. And I think I had that starting from more than 20 years ago, when that wasn't necessarily as easy to have. I think now the world has become such that you can have that a bit more easily. And I feel like when things happen, whatever they may be, but for example, the Delhi gang rape that happened 4 years ago, and I was on tour globally, and of course I'm an Indian female musician, so this was something I was speaking about around the world, and so I could kind of see the difference between perspectives and situations in France versus different parts of America to India to London, and so there's just this kind of amazing opportunity to see how people's perspectives and experiences mean they internalize stories in completely different ways.
Just to remind people, that was the horrific case that happened where a girl was going home from the cinema.
December 16th, 2012 it was, and she was gang raped by five men, and the kind of particular brutality of it meant that it kind of was massive world news, rightly so. And I think I was one of probably everyone I knew that was deeply, deeply, I want to say, traumatized by that story. You know, I felt it and I carried it, and I know a lot of women did.
I mean, talking about it now, I still feel it. I still feel it
in my stomach. It's this really horrible thing where, for some reason, in that moment, the whole world stopped and was talking about that story. And to me, in my experience, I feel like that was the moment that has kind of generated this new wave of feminism that has continued to build for different reasons around the world. But that was the first moment in my lifetime that I remember the whole world talking about women and sexual violence at the same time.
And it changed your life as well, because you talked about your own experience of it and your own abuse. Yeah. For the first time in your life, you made that public. Explain why you did that.
It's hard to explain, because I feel like it was coming from a place of pain, not necessarily kind of a carefully thought out process. You know, it was emotional, you know, where I had felt that experience that had happened to her, as I saw so many people feel. But at the same time, I was seeing people, you know, analyze the story as well in different ways. And there was, you know, one of the things that I saw start to come out was that perhaps part of why her story resonated so strongly was because she was a middle-class girl. And so people in India were able to identify with her more than they could with all the other people that this might be happening to. And so that was what was giving it more attention. And that kind of pocketed away somewhere in my brain where I thought, yeah, we don't talk about this. You know, we don't talk about it. So there will still be this feeling that this doesn't happen in certain quarters. This doesn't happen to certain types of people, you know. And suddenly that just felt like I couldn't go on with that anymore, because I just thought this might not make a difference, but to just say it happens everywhere, because I know if people knew it happens to me, then you can't say it doesn't happen to any kind of person.
I'm so brave and courageous to have done that. And actually you're right, because for Anushka Shankar to step up and go, well, this happened to me, because everyone would look at you as one of the most privileged young women in India, you know, this wonderful world that you grew up in and this fabulous life that you've lived. And yet you stepped up to say, actually, it's happened to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that would have really made people sit up and pay attention, because it makes national news.
It does. And I think it's just that thing of like, sexual violence happens anywhere, anytime. And obviously, as we know, not just to girls and to women, you know, and so it's just like you have to remove the taboos and the stigma, because there is just this intrinsic level at which victims feel the shame in this crime in particular. And so to be able to kind of start a process of just going, I can say it happened to me, because this isn't my secret to have to keep anymore. The shame is not on me, you know? And I think that makes a difference. And we see now, you know, this is, you know, a few years on, what's happening in a really seismic level when people really start to speak and come forward. And it's really, really amazing to watch what's happening.
It is amazing. And it's phenomenal that so many women have come forward, and everybody's really shocked. And I'm shocked and you're shocked. We're all shocked. But at the same time, I'm not.
Yes.
I'm not surprised. People have said, is this really been happening? And as a woman, I'm going, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just that we've just swallowed it up and accepted it. So when someone makes a sexist remark at work, it makes you feel hideous. You feel awkward and weird, and you just suck it up because you don't want to rock the boat, because you know, and that's appalling that's
mm-hmm. how we've been made to feel. So mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah. And you talk about the shame, and that's global. But the reason I wanted to talk about you particularly talking about your experience in India, I mean, tell me if you think I'm wrong, but it's even bright in a way. It's so hard in India to talk about these things, because the shame that is attached to it is huge, that even within families, people can't open up about like abuse or anything that's handled, because people don't know how to deal with it. They won't accept it. And girls are obviously just often just told to just shut up and get on with it, you know?
It's tricky, isn't it? Because I don't have an answer for you as to why that is. But one of the things I can't help feeling, like, if sex and sexuality in themselves have a stigma and a silence and a shame around them, then where do you even begin with sexual abuse and sexual violence?
You're so right. You know, today I heard on the news that they've banned a condom advert from television in India because... But this is the land of the Kama Sutra, man.
I'm wordless right now.
yeah. They've banned a condom advert. Mm.
It's, yeah, where do you even begin?
I didn't.
So there's, yes.
Yeah.
So, yes. So what was the back, what was the reaction?
What was your reaction that you got, actually?
I mean, to be honest, I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't prepared for the level of reaction. Because, I mean, for me, I mean, the bigger bird's eye view for me is that that gang rape happened 5 days after my dad died. And so I think what I did emotionally was kind of pair those two events in some way, where I was kind of grieving my dad and also grieving this story of what had happened to a woman I never even knew, but kind of felt like all women felt, you know. And so I was still grieving and quite raw, very vulnerable. And I put that story out because that felt like the right thing to do. But I wasn't prepared, perhaps naively, I wasn't prepared for the level to which that was going to kind of go global and be a big piece of news. And so I didn't necessarily take care of myself very well around that, because whereas I had released the video kind of by recording it on my iPhone, myself in a room, so I'd said exactly what I wanted to say, I hadn't put that kind of PR thought into, and for this whole next year with this album I'm releasing, I'm going to be asked this by every different reporter in a different country, and I'm prepared for how to word my answers, or how, like, someone actually just who I'd never met sat down and went, but let's be clear, were you actually raped at that point or not? And you know, something like that where it's a man I've never met before asking me a sentence.
Someone
like
ask
that.
You that?
Yeah. I'll tell you later which publication. But, you know, it's stuff like that where I hadn't prepared for the fact that what me sharing my story would mean to other people was that now there were no boundaries and that, you know, I needed to learn how to keep my own boundaries around how much I was prepared to share. And that was a kind of learning curve that I was on the back foot with a little bit because I did it so impulsively and emotionally. I don't regret it, but I think now I've had some time to kind of prepare around, I'm sitting here and this is how much I'm prepared to say to you and I'm comfortable with that, but I won't go two steps further if someone is pushing me, you know?
Yeah. Learn to be able to say, I don't want to
answer that. Yeah. And you're allowed to say that.
That's something I've learned as well, because I'm very good at just going, blah, blah, I need to answer everything. It's fine to just go, you know, that's...
Yeah. Well, I think another thing we kind of swallow as women is this kind of notion that we're just supposed to be nice. So you put me in a position where I'm doing press from when I'm 13 years old and having to kind of make sure everyone thinks I'm nice, you know. And so the idea that somehow you also know how to say, I'm not comfortable with that. Sorry, I'm not going to answer that. Pff, you don't know how to do that. It's like, of course, I'm going to answer anything you tell me because I'm just going to make sure you think that I'm nice and lovely and clever and da 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 da. So yeah,
but you're also a badass who can say no, and it's fine to say that because then they can't print it.
No, that's the kind of like I like growing up. There are some things I know how to do now in my 30s that I wish I could tell myself at 18, 20 how to do. But that's just part of the process, isn't it?
No regrets, though, right?
No regrets. I accept that, if any, because I generally say no regrets. But if any, I feel like I could have been more of a badass. I think like through a lot of my teenage and 20s, I was being a creative artist in the public eye, but was very careful to put the right foot forward. You know, that concept of legacy and all of that stuff. And it took me a while to start to find my way with just trusting that I can be my own person and be my own artist.
Was that pressure you were putting on yourself? Or do you think that came from elsewhere where they were like, behave in a certain way?
No one was actively telling me to do that, but you imbibe this stuff, you know. It was definitely what I did to myself. I think, you know, and you see some people just kind of come out that with that kind of amazing rebellious spirit, even though they're really, really young and able to just put their stuff out there with that confidence. And I think, oh, I wish I could have done that, you know, but also it happened exactly the way it was meant to. And I'm fine with that.
And like you say, you were that badass spirit inside you. You just had this phenomenal ability. This is how I would put it. To actually see how to behave in a certain environment. I think that in itself is emotional intelligence that not everybody has. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think if you knew, just from knowing you now and what you said, and so now it's the right time. Now you're absolutely within, you've kind of grown into your confidence and know who you are, where you can go, and I breathe fire. I play the sitar like an angel and I breathe fire like a dragon.
That's my new t-shirt. Yeah. Thank you.
I understand what you mean because I feel the same. I did this thing where like I've just always been quite rebellious, had this really strong spirit and been very willful. And yet I would go into meetings. It's a completely different world to you, Anushka. I mean, you've been on stage and traveled the world and all the rest of it and had to do interviews with international publications. But I'd just walk into a meeting and my shoulders would go up and my eyes would become twice as wide and I would just... Yes, and just want to please and walk out going, they don't want to employ me. I'm just some like, you know, where's my spirit? Why didn't I show them who I am? Mm-hmm. But I'm learning.
Yeah. It's a learning process. And I think, again, there's that kind of cultural thing too, where we are really trained to be nice girls, aren't we?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, my mum has this thing where she loves the fact that I'm independent. She's really proud of my career. And yet she will always have to tell everybody that I can make round chapatis. What the hell?
You're one up on me there, love.
I don't, by the way, I can, but I don't. I choose not to because I cannot be bothered.
Yeah.
Sometimes if I want to eat a nice homemade chapati, I will cook it fine, but it's the expectation, like, stop it, mum.
Whereas my six-year-old called someone out on being sexist in front of me last week, and I thought, okay, I've done my job, you know, this is good. He was like, that's a really sexist thing to say. Boys can do that, and girls shouldn't have to do that. And I thought, oh, I love you so much right now.
Bringing up two feminists. Yeah. So what's next? What's happening now? Yeah, I mean, you've just finished the tour in India.
Finished the tour with the silent film Shiraz that I scored, which is going to come out on DVD in February. And I just found out they're going to screen it on a limited release, like at the BFI, for example, in February for about a week or so, and other theatres are too. I'm going to take some time next year to write a new album. So I don't know what that's going to be yet, but we'll see. And before that is a little holiday with my boys in Sri Lanka.
Lovely, really nice. Tell us about Shiraz. And
so Shiraz is this lovely film from 1927 that was one of the first films made in India. And it's a silent film. It's a love story. And it's a very fictionalized account of the love story behind the building of the Taj Mahal. So there's a kind of fictional character called Shiraz who's part of this story in the film. And he's the one that eventually goes on to be the architect who designs the Taj Mahal. And it's a shocking piece of work in the sense that I'd never seen anything of that scale made in India from that time. Lots of beautiful artistic work in there and stuff like two really passionate kisses that I'd never seen.
No.
Yes.
Shock horror.
Yeah.
Go come figure. With a warning.
I know. It's funny because here at the bar beginning, you know, no one gasped about that. But the first show in Hyderabad, you could hear the whole audience go, because you just don't expect to see it in a black and white film. And it's fascinating that it started there in the 20s and don't know when it kind of, when it changed.
When it turned into just the bush shaking.
Yeah. And the birds.
And the birds. Yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
End of Empire. I don't know. That's the next podcast. We'll discuss that. So that's explain what happened in Bombay, because you said this the other night to me.
I had to explain it. So basically, this film that I've scored was also booked as a live show. So it's the first time I've ever played live in front of a film, which is technically the most challenging thing I've ever done because of the kind of work required to stay in sync with the film the whole time. And so there are things like bar numbers and sort of click that help us stay with the film. And at the fifth show in Bombay, that equipment all broke in the first 3 minutes. And we had a smiling internal panic, you know, every person in my band and crew. And I don't know what to say other than that we did the show.
How did you do the show?
We panicked behind smiling faces and one scene at a time nailed it, you know. And it was really funny because afterwards we kind of came off stage and thought, how funny that no one else would. That was probably a less good show than the other four shows. But to us and to me, we were heroes. You know, and that's something that I love about being on stage is like you just have to make it work. You have to give your audience the show that they've come for. So you make it happen.
How did you keep time? How did everyone keep time?
I kept banging my foot really loudly.
This woman kept time with and everybody kept up with your foot.
Yeah.
I can't.
It's so amazing. Like, oh no, you are a hero. Everyone listening to this will know that you and your band are heroes.
Because how many pieces had you broken that like score into?
Well, I mean, it's an hour, 47 minutes of music. So we had 35 scenes and we had a lot of material. It was definitely the most stressful show I've ever done. And I couldn't stop speaking at shouting level for about 3 hours after the show from adrenaline. It was hilarious.
Yeah, when you come off stage and something's gone that badly wrong.
Run an Olympic marathon or something. It's just...
You did that.
You did that. You nailed it. You nailed it. Yeah, we haven't even mentioned your sister.
Yeah,
we've got to let's mention, like, you won't know, but you might know, you probably will know, but your sister is Nora Jones, who is another hero, like, just amazing, amazing jazz singer, songwriter. When did you discover that she was your sister?
So I knew she was my sister from when I was born. The world didn't discover that I had a sister until I was about 20, which is when she released her first album. So obviously that's when they started taking interest. None of us had a secret. No one gave a shit. Do you know what I mean? Until she was making music and there was a story to tell. So the story was told in the most dramatic way possible. And that was something for us all to weather, you know, because of course it's weird when stuff's out in the public that's not quite how it is. But we've been very close from the beginning.
Your dad's genes are amazing, aren't they?
Yeah, they're like not
two gorgeous girls, amazing musicians, so talented. And have you worked together?
We've worked together on a couple of things. First, on the Breathing Underwater album I did with Kersh Kale, we did one song. And then we worked a bit more elaborately together on my album called Traces of You, which is the one I was writing when my father passed away. So at that point, I'd already spoken to her about being on the album. And then like all this stuff just started pouring out and I wanted her to be on it. So we did three songs together at that point. Yeah, it's funny. Like obviously we haven't worked together a huge amount, but I think there's a sort of trust and relationship that's already there. So the working together just flowed very easily.
I watched something really moving actually when you both went to receive your dad's Grammy.
Oh,
Yeah, and the two of you went. It's really moving. And he only just passed away a few months earlier.
It was about 2 months before that, and so he got the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys. I guess almost 5 years ago now, and so we accepted it together, which was amazing.
It was amazing. Amazing to watch these two talented, gorgeous sisters get up on stage to talk about their phenomenal father. But what struck me was how self-assured you, both of you, but how wonderfully you spoke and how eloquently and how hilariously and how you were standing there and you had in the palm of your hands the entire audience. And I thought, now she is a badass.
Why, thank you.
I want to say thank you so much. I feel that we will do another podcast in the future when you've got a new album to talk about. I want to say, Anushka, that you are officially a Rani's Rani. So I am crowning you.
Awesome.
Yes, so welcome to the club. You are incredible, and thank you so much for your time and allowing me into your inner sanctum and having that wonderful intimate moment where you played the sitar for me. I'll treasure that for as long as I live. Thank you so much. If you enjoyed that podcast, please leave a review on iTunes and tell all your friends. We want to get as many people on board as we can. You can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram, It's Anita Rani, or go to my website, itsanitarani.com. Next week, I'm going to be talking to the incredible Scout Ambassador, the first Black British man to have walked to the North Pole, Dwayne Fields. See you on the next one.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.